heard on 757-274-6983. Now, by the way, we have a tremendous guest for you. Steve Snyder is our guest today. His father was Howard Snyder. Steve is the author of the book called Shot Down. Now, this is the true story of pilot Howard Snyder and the crew of the B-17 Susan Ruth. And I'd like to welcome to the show Steve Snyder. Steve, how you doing, my friend?
I'm doing terrific. Thank you very much.
I haven't talked to you in a little while.
Yeah, it has been. Hope you're ready for the holidays.
I'm getting ready for them. I'm getting warmed up. Hopefully we'll get a little snow. I don't know what part of the country you're in, but over here on the East Coast, we like to see at least a white Christmas once in a while. Wouldn't be bad.
Well, yeah, I was back in New Jersey about a week ago and had some snow, but I'm back home here in Southern California, so no snow for me over Christmas.
No, and you know what? I only want to see the show once a year. I just want to, if you're going to freeze in the winter, at least let me see the snow one time. You know, then let it go away, and I don't want to see it again. I just want to see the show once a year. Listen, you have an amazing story to tell, and I could waste a lot of time talking about yourself and me, but let's get into this because you are the immediate past president of the 306th Bomb Group Historical Association. You're a speaker, you're an author, and it's just amazing. This story's amazing. So why don't we start at the beginning, and I'm just going to let you tell a story, and periodically, if I have something I'd like to ask about, I'll interject, okay?
Okay. Well, it is quite a story. You know, growing up, I knew the basics of my dad's World War II history. He was a B-17 pilot, and he was stationed in England with the 8th Air Force. And his plane was named the Susan Ruth after my oldest sister.
And those were the B-17 bombers.
Right.
Yes. They were famous.
Right. The B-17 and also the B-24, they both were used in Europe, although the B-17 is a lot more famous than the B-24, to the chagrin of the B-24
fans. Yes, of course.
And as I was saying, my dad's plane was named the Susan Ruth after my oldest sister, who was 1 year old at the time that he went overseas, and he flew bombing missions over Europe. And on February 8th of 1944, his plane was shot down by two German Focke-Wulf fighter planes. And he bailed out, and he was missing in action for 7 months, but he evaded capture and eventually made it back to England. I retired in 2009, and then I had really the time to delve into my dad's war history in more detail. At that time, I had no intention of writing a book. I just wanted to learn more, and my parents had kept a lot of material from the war years, and two items were really significant. One was a diary that my dad wrote about his plane being shot down. He wrote it while he was missing in action, and it was absolutely riveting. It's in the book. And then the other is all the letters that my dad had written to my mother while he was stationed in England, and reading those letters was absolutely fascinating. And I just became fascinated with the story of my dad and his crew. It became my passion.
Well,
and
back
after
up,
3
back
years
up for
of doing
minute.
Research, I decided to write a book.
Well, back up for a minute. Tell me, he got shot down twice, you said?
No, he was just shot down once.
He was shot down once.
Right.
Okay, and where was that he was shot down?
Right over the French-Belgian border. In fact, when the plane was attacked, two of the crew were killed in the plane, and the other 8 crewmen, B-17, had a 10-man crew. And they bailed out, and my dad and the plane came down in Belgium, but all the other guys that were able to bail out came down in France. So it was right on the French-Belgian border.
Okay, so take us from there.
Okay, after my dad bailed out, he came down into some trees, and his parachute got hung up in the trees, and he was dangling 20 feet off the ground and couldn't get down. But fortunately for him, a couple young Belgian men, Henri Franken and Raymond Durvin, came to his rescue before the Germans got to him. They went back to the farmhouse, got a ladder and a rope, helped him down. And this was took place in early afternoon. They told him to stay put and hide until nighttime because they thought it was too dangerous to try to move him during the daylight with German patrols combing the area looking for these U.S. airmen who had bailed out. So that night they came back and got him, took him to the Durvan farmhouse where he stayed one night because they thought it was too dangerous for him to stay there any longer with those German patrols in the area. And a Belgian customs officer, Paul Tilcan, came and got him on a tandem bicycle, and they went to another location. Kind of a funny story right there is that they're riding this tandem bicycle, and it was the middle of the night, pitch black, kind of drizzling, and they came to a hill and couldn't pedal up the hill anymore, so they started pushing the bike up the hill. And they came to the top of the hill, and there was a cabaret, a little cafe there, and the lights were on, music was playing, people were laughing and talking loudly, and all of a sudden two German officers come out with their arms around these young girls, and one of the German officers walks up to my dad, puts his arm around my dad, and asks him for a light for a cigarette. Well, my dad was pretty petrified at that moment because he couldn't speak French or German, but Paul Tilcan was able to. He lit the guy's cigarette, and then they went on their way. My dad said the two Germans were too drunk and too interested in these young girls to pay too much attention to a couple guys pushing a bike up the hill in the middle of the night. And from after that, he was moved from place to place to place.
Well, let's stop here for a minute, Steve. I want to ask you this. How do you know this? Is this in your dad's diary?
No, that's not in his diary.
How do you know these people's names and the hill and the cabaret? How do you know all of that?
Well, there, it is pretty amazing.
Yes, it is.
You know, my dad told me a lot of the information, but I probably wouldn't have written the book if it wasn't for two Belgian gentlemen, Dr. Paul Delahaye and Jacques Lalot. These two men were young boys during the war, and they were greatly affected by it. They saw firsthand the atrocities committed by the Nazis against their family and friends. And later in life, they became local historians, and they interviewed these Belgian people and members of the Belgium underground about events that took place involving my dad and his crew, and they documented their testimony. And they gave me unbelievably detailed information because of their dedicated research that would have been lost forever without their effort. So I owe them a huge debt. And while I was writing the book, I was thinking to myself, people are going to read this book and go, how in the heck does this guy know all these details?
Well, that's what I was
about
thinking.
About events that took place 70 years ago.
Hey,
and it's all based on firsthand testimony.
Hey, and not just 70 years ago, Steve, during a war. Hear about the fog of war, right? You're getting all these details through the fog of war.
Well, also, my dad, after the war, he kept in contact with a lot of the people that helped him. They would exchange Christmas cards, and actually, you know, he made some trips back to Belgium later in life and was reunited with some of these people. Actually, like most World War II veterans, my dad didn't talk a lot about the war until 1989. And in 1989, the Belgium Association, their historical association, built a memorial to my dad and his crew. And my dad and the other three members of the crew that were still living at the time went over for the dedication. And that's where he was reunited with a lot of these Belgian people that hit him during the war, saw those places where he was hidden, and that brought it all back, and he started talking about it a lot more after that. So, yeah, I am so lucky and so blessed that I know so much about the war history of my dad, because most people know very little about their veteran.
Right, exactly. My father served in World War II, and he was in combat with a merchant, but he was with the Merchant Marines. And you know as well as I do, they lost more people than even the Marine Corps lost. Because they were the supply lines to the ships. And I have he's passed now, and he has never told me one sentence.
That's a familiar story, I hear.
And his medals just arrived about 6 months before he passed away. They recognized the Merchant Marines as part of the military about 6 months ago. And right before he passed away, he got his medals. But I knew nothing about what he did except that he was in World War II and he was one of the greatest generation and he was my dad and I loved him. That's it.
Oh, yeah.
So you're very lucky in my opinion.
Oh, unbelievably fortunate that I know so much detail about what happened to my dad. Yeah, it's amazing.
Well, listen, we're only going to have about 40 seconds left, so get us set up for what we're going to continue this story with. So start us on the way, but keep in mind you got 40 seconds before I'm going to take a break.
Okay. As I mentioned, after Paul Kilcan came and got him, he was moved from place to place to place. How long he stayed at any location depended on how brave the Belgian people were who lived there and how dangerous the underground thought it was for him to stay there. He might spend one night, he might spend 6 weeks.
All right, let's leave it there. We'll be right back. We're talking to Steve Snyder, ladies and gentlemen, author of the book Shot Down, True Story of Pilot Howard Snyder and the crew of the B-17, Susan Ruth.
Hey, it's me, your cell phone. We need to talk about something. Something serious. I know you love me. I know you like using me wherever you are, but I feel like this isn't working out when you're driving. I know you may think that it's possible to focus both on me and the road, but I just don't feel the same way. I think we should spend time away from each other when you're driving. It's for the best.
Visit StopTextStopWrecks.org, a message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, and the Ad Council.
When you want the best selection of tropical fish, dog and cat grooming accessories, bird and livestock feed, or a pond for your garden, head over to Dave's Pets at 3515 Main Street in Exmoor, Virginia. Dave's Pets has the best selection on the Eastern Shore. Give them a call at 757-442-7442, 757-442-7442. Dave's Pets, the name you want to remember.
It's time to eat, but everyone wants something different. Let me recommend Jerry's Restaurante, 22115 Langford Highway in Cape Charles. They serve the entire eastern shore of Virginia, from fresh slices for lunch or a full gluten-free pizza for dinner. Maybe try one of their subs, calzones, salads, or strombolis. Everyone will find something they'll love. Jerry's Restaurante, 22115 Langford Highway in Cape Charles, 757-331-1140. Open convenient hours. And police, teachers, military, and first responders get a 10% discount every day. Jerry's Restaurante.
Northampton Firearms LLC is a full-range dealership for your pistol and rifle needs, offering a large supply of ammo, on-site gunsmithing, and knife sharpening services. Located in the heart of downtown Cherryton, 21230 Bayside in Cape Charles, Virginia. Northampton Firearms, 757-331-1900, 757-331-1900. Like us on Facebook.
Welcome back to the Specialist Radio Hour.
This is America, Jack.
With Chris Kettner.
Ladies and gentlemen, again, thanks for tuning in. Listen, we're talking to a great American, great patriot. His father flew the B-17 bombers. They were very, very famous bombers during the war. It was called the Susan Ruth. It was immortalized. He was shot down. Fortunately for Steve Snyder, he has the entire history, basically, of what happened to his father after he was shot down during and moving forward. And he is the author of the book called Shot Down, The True Story of Pilot Howard Snyder and the Crew. They had usually a crew of 10 people, of the B-17, Susan Ruth. Okay, go ahead, Howard. I mean, go ahead, Steve.
Okay. You mentioned about the crew, not only do I know what happened to my dad in detail, but I also know what happened to each member of the, that, a 10-man crew in detail. And because the book's just not about my dad. It's about what happened to each member of the crew. And it's also about all the courageous Belgian people that risked their lives trying to help them.
You know, isn't it unbelievable the technology? Now we have crew of two and three. But back in those days, we had crews of 8 and 10.
Oh, yeah. you needed hundreds. Back then, you needed hundreds of bombers dropping their bombs to try to hit a target. Today, you only need one stealth bomber, and they can do more damage than hundreds of planes.
I know. It's quite amazing to me. But go ahead. Let's finish with this. Keep us going with the story. This is exciting.
Okay. As I was saying, my dad was moved around from place to place, and the Belgian people that hid my dad were unbelievably brave people. They risked not only their lives, but those of their family and friends, aiding these downed airmen. Because if the German secret police, the Gestapo, found out about it, they would be arrested, tortured, and either sent to concentration camps or executed. And some of the people that helped my dad and other members of his crew did meet that fate. But it was also really stressful for my dad because here he is. His planes was attacked. It's on fire. He has to bail out. He comes down in a foreign country, has no idea where he is, doesn't know what happened to his buddies on the crew, can't communicate with the U.S. military, and he's being helped by complete strangers. They can't really communicate because he can't speak French when he first comes down. And any one of these people could be a collaborator and turn him over to the Gestapo. And while hiding at these
was he wounded?
Places,
was he wounded?
Well, he was. He had some wounds, but he was compared to some of the other members of the crew. He wasn't wounded that badly. He had some shrapnel wounds in one of his legs and some minor burns on his face from the fire in the cockpit. But he wasn't injured. Most of that was superficial.
Okay.
As I was saying, he was in these homes. At any time, the Gestapo could break in and either arrest him or shoot him. And he had some close calls that are described in the book of almost being discovered. Finally, he got tired of hiding. Word came that the Allies had landed at Normandy, on D-Day, June 6th of 44. And he decided to get back in the fight. He joined the French resistance. Much to the chagrin of his helpers, they told him that that he should not do that. It was way too dangerous because he could be killed in the fight while fighting the Germans, or if the Germans captured him, they'd just shoot him on the spot for being a spy or a terrorist. But he wanted to get back in the fight, and actually he had experience, like most airmen, before he went in the Air Force. He was in the Army for a year, so he knew how to fight on the ground. So he joined the French resistance. They were called the Mackie. They were made up of small, independent, ragtag guerrilla groups all over France. His group had about 20 guys in it, led by a French lieutenant who had escaped from a German prisoner of war camp. And there was a few other Frenchmen, some Belgium, and some Algerians, who my dad said were really vicious fighters. So they harassed the Germans. They disrupt communications, sabotage railroad lines, attack convoys, assassinate German officers, and they got their instructions from the British through coded messages over the BBC, and they were supplied by the British through airdrops. And described in the book are several skirmishes that the Mackie group had with the Germans. My dad said the information that the British gave was unbelievably accurate. If they said a German convoy was coming down this road on this day at this time, sure enough, they'd be there. And that was a result of the British cracking the Germans' Enigma code and knowing everything the Germans were up to. So he fought with the French resistance for 2 or 3 months, and then finally on September 2nd, 7 months after his plane was shot down, word came that there were U.S. troops in a nearby village of Trelon, France. So he walked into the village in the town square, went up to an army major, actually was an element of Patton's Third Army, which had come up through France after D-Day, identified himself. They interrogated him to make sure he was who he said he was, and he hopped on a convoy that was going to Paris, and then got a ride on a cargo C-47 plane back to England, where he sent a telegram to my mother saying he was fit as a fiddle and to bank the money, honey, because he all had all that back pay coming to him.
That's great. That is great. So then what happens?
Well, then, and my dad was completely separated from the other members of his crew. He, after he bailed out, he had no idea what happened to any of the other nine guys. And it wasn't until he got back to England that he found out that two of the crew had been killed in the plane when it was attacked by the German fighters. And then three of the other men had been captured and were prisoners of war. And then...
Which is worse than being killed, really.
Well, yeah, actually, two of those guys, Joe Musial and Richard Daniels. Joe Musial was one of the waste gunners. Richard Daniels was the bombardier. They had such bad injuries. Joe Musial had his foot blown off, and Richard Daniels had his one of his arms almost taken off. Their injuries were so bad that they were repatriated back to the U.S. before the war ended. They came back to the U.S. in January of 1945. And then Roy Hulbert, the other crew member who was the flight engineer, he spent the entire war as a POW. And then, but they didn't know what happened to the other guys on the crew until later on. But they sent my dad back to the U.S. He became a B-17 flight instructor for the remainder of the war. The Air Force had a rule that if you were shot down over occupied territory and aided by the underground, that you couldn't go back into combat, because they thought if you were going to, you could flew again and you were shot down and the Germans captured you and tortured you, that you'd give up the identity of the people that helped you the first time that you were shot down. The only exception to that I'm aware of is Chuck Yeager, who personally met with General Eisenhower and talked him into letting him go back into combat.
Well, you know what? That was very nice of them to do that. Those days are gone. But that was awful considerate of them.
Yeah. Because my dad was shot down on his eighth mission. At the time he was shot down, the mission limit was 25. If you completed 25 missions, you could come home. And that was, and then it was eventually when Jimmy Doodle took over the 8th Air Force as the commanding officer, he eventually raised it to 30 and 35 because of the German Air Force basically being wiped out later on in the war. At the beginning of the war, there was the air war. There was no mission limits at all. The 8th Air Force flew their first mission on August 17th of 1942.
We're going to take a quick break. I'm forced to advocate for some of my sponsors. We'll be right back. We got a lot more excitement to talk about because you actually met some of the people that he was involved with. We'll be right back. Stars and Stripes Radio. Talk 365.live.
SAS.
One Nation Under God.
Stars and Stripes Radio. We as Americans have the capacity now as we've had in the past to do whatever needs to be done to preserve this last and greatest bastion of freedom.
Wake up and text. Text and eat. Mm-mm. Text and meet up with a friend you haven't seen in forever.
Hi.
Oh, hey.
Text and complain that they're on their phone the whole time. Text and listen to them complain that you're on your phone the whole time. Text and whatever. But when you get behind the wheel, give your phone to a passenger. Put it in the glove box. Just don't text and drive. Visit StopTextsStopWrecks.org. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
I have a restaurant riddle for you. What restaurant won the 2018 Certificate of Excellence, offers gluten-free options, is vegetarian-friendly, offers takeout, and has authentic Mexican cuisine? It's El Magway Authentic Mexican Restaurant, 2638 Langford Highway in Exmoor. Just call 757-442-2900. That's 757-442-2900. El Magway has seating and table service and wheelchair accessible. Great services, great prices. El Magway Authentic Mexican Restaurant, Exmoor.
We've all been there. The dripping faucets, slow drains, hot water issues. At first, we think of them as small problems. And that's the perfect time to call the Herbert Senn Company at 757-442-6186. From small repairs to new construction. Solve your plumbing problems today by calling the Herbert Senn Company at 757-442-6186. The Herbert Senn Company, always looking to hire qualified, motivated individuals.
When you need fast food that isn't a burger and fries, you need Molly's Fruit. Molly's Fruit is a smoothie and juice bar and restaurant serving healthy foods that taste great, including made-to-order wraps and smoothies, rice bowls, salads, and more. Molly's Fruit is also available to cater small events. Once you check out the reviews for Molly's Fruit on Facebook, you'll want to head right over to Molly's Fruit at 25318 Langford Highway in Olney, Virginia. Molly's Fruit, always fresh, always delicious.
Welcome back to the Specialist Radio Hour.
This is America, Jack.
With Chris Kettner.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking to Steve Snyder. His father is famous Howard Snyder. Steve is the author of Shot Down, the true story of pilot Howard Snyder and the crew of the B-17, the Susan Ruth. And the Susan Ruth is famous because that was Howard Snyder's daughter. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes, that was his. He named the bomber the Susan Ruth. And you know what? I've heard about that my whole childhood, about the Susan Ruth. From history classes and stuff, I'd heard about the Susan Ruth. I just didn't know the backstory, and that's why I'm so thrilled that you were kind enough to come back on again and go into more depth. All right, go ahead. You're in charge of the story. You keep going.
Okay. Well, I've been to Belgium six times. The first time was with my dad in 1994, and that's when it became personal for me because he took me around and I saw these places, you know, where history took place, places where he stayed. And I met a couple of the people
now,
that
now
helped
let me
him
ask you
during
this.
The war.
Steve, let me ask you this, and I'm not asking to be facetious. I'm asking because I'm just a simple man. I go to my hometown where I was born and raised in Richmond, Virginia, and nothing looks the same. How in the heck does your father, I don't know how many years later, 20 or 30 years later, when you're old enough to travel with him and understand the war and what he went through, you're going to go back to Belgium and find these places that he hid out while he was a war, while he was basically hiding in the middle of a world war. How do these places even still exist?
Well, it's a little. Europe doesn't tear everything down and rebuild it like we do in the U.S. And where my dad was in southern Belgium, it's very rural. It's pretty much all farmland. And
okay.
Things really haven't changed in hundreds of years there. And so many of the places, the houses or farms where my dad or other members of his crew hid are still there. And to go there and go inside these buildings and go into rooms where my dad stayed, you know, 75 years ago,
it's gotta be unbelievable.
I get chills just talking about it.
Yeah, it's got to be unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. I'm so fortunate not only to know the story, but to be able to go to these places and actually go in these places where my dad hid and where the story took place.
And are the people the same people too?
No, all my dad's helpers have passed away, but I'm friends with some of sons or grandsons or granddaughters or, you know, relatives of people who met my dad. And I made some just some dear lifelong friends over in Belgium.
Did your father ever make any marks? You know how I forgot what that was, that thing they used to do in World War II, I believe it was, that let them know that so-and-so was here. Did he ever make any mark on any place that he stayed just to remind himself that, so when you came back, you said, I made that mark back in 19 so-and-so. Did he do anything like that?
No, I don't think that ever entered his mind at the time. It was I went to this one house in the town of Charleroi, Belgium, and I was with some other guys. We took some cameras over there. We were filming to make a documentary, and the man who lived there he poked his head out the second story, and like as we were. Asked us what we were doing. He could speak English, and so we told him that my dad had was hidden there for a lengthy period of time, and I had a bunch of pictures. And that's another thing that's pretty incredible. There's over 200 time period photographs in the book, and many of them were taken by Belgian people in 1944, and were either given to sent to my dad by his helpers or were given to me by Dr. Delahaye and Jacques Lalonde.
Wow.
So I have these pictures taken in 1944. And so I was showing him one picture, and it shows my dad sitting. And in the background, there's this wall covering. He goes, oh, my goodness, that wall covering is still there today.
Wow.
So he took us in the house into the room where my dad sat, and that wall covering is still there 75 years later, the same wall covering.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
That's unreal.
Yeah, yeah. And every time I go to Belgium, I learn a little something new, a piece of the story, or find out a new location.
Well, you know, you're so right. I didn't even take into consideration the fact that in America we tear stuff down so fast, and that when I showed my wife, for example, where I grew up, heck, I didn't even recognize where the land was. It was all so different. The shopping centers were gone. This was gone. Where probably in places like Belgium and things like that, they didn't do that.
No, No, not at all. Yeah, you know, it's similar. It's like that in England too, because you know, my dad was in the 306 bomb group, which was based at Thurlow, England, which is about 60 miles north of London. And up there around Thurlow and that area, it's mostly farmland, and even there, you know, things haven't changed. There's lots of buildings that are hundreds of years old that they just still use. You know, they put plumbing or electricity in it or what have you, but it's still a stone building, and it's still there, and they still use it. They don't tear it down and then build something more modern.
Let me ask you this, and this is off the beaten path, but just curious. Why do you think that is? Why do you think that, like in Belgium or some of the European countries, they don't do that? In other words, is it a cultural thing? Is it a historical thing? Or is it they don't have the people, the population growth, or what?
You know, that's a good question. That's hard. I can't really answer that. But for an example, on this last trip I took to Belgium in September for the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Belgium and my dad's being shot down, we discovered a house that my dad's tail gunner stayed at for a couple months. I ran across, or she found me actually, the granddaughter of a woman that hit Bill Schlenker, my dad's tail gunner. And she, this was in France, right across the border. So she took it. She owns the little stone house now. It was a little tiny farm. And she's renovating the inside. She's going to have it kind of as a vacation home. But it's a stone building, and it's hundreds of years old. And she's not going to tear it down. You know, she's just going to remodel it inside a little bit. They just don't tear it down and build something new. That's just what they do.
Wow. Well, you know what? There's something to be said for that, because the people that travel all over the world, that's part of the fascination, is the architecture.
Yeah, yeah.
That's part of why they go, is to see these old buildings and the architecture and how other people lived hundreds and hundreds of years ago.
So it's fun to go over there, because I have these old pictures from during the war, and then you kind of put them up against the setting of today, and you can just see, oh, this is it looks the same.
Now, here's what we're going to do. I know I'm going to have to take a break soon, but not yet. But I'm trying to set the timing up so that I know you took a trip, you and your dad, and you actually met face-to-face, eyeball-to-eyeball, with the pilot that shot your father down.
Yep.
So I don't want to start that right now. How much time have I got? I'm asking my producer. We got about 2 minutes and 25 seconds, so lead us up to that, but don't get us there yet, okay?
Okay.
We'll start the new break on the eyeball-to-eyeball confrontation.
Well, during my research, one day my wife casually said, well, why don't you try to find the German pilot that shot down your dad's plane, which I thought was, you know, a ridiculous idea. I thought it'd be totally impossible. He probably died in the war. It's 70 years later. He's passed away by now. I can't speak German. But like a good husband, I did what she told me to do, and I did find the pilot. His name is Hans Berger. And fortunately for me, he became a translator after the war, so he speaks perfect English. And he gave me some wonderful insight that's in the book about what it was like to go up against the 8th Air Force.
You know what's incredible? We hate to admit it, but if we just listen to our wives more, we would have been spared more heartache in some... Do you know the story of Joe Gibbs?
No. The football coach?
Football coach and four-time NASCAR champion, yes.
Oh, okay.
And a definite Christian. If you get some spare time, talking about what we're talking about right now, listening to a woman, you won't believe this man's life story. Nothing to do with football. Everything to do with not listening to his wife, going completely bankrupt while he's winning the Super Bowls. The press never got a whiff of it. He finally did what she said to do and turned his life over to God. And he becomes Super Bowl champion, quits football, and goes to NASCAR, wins four NASCAR championships, and he's the most, you know, an incredibly successful man. But he does what his wife says. Look, we'll take a quick break, and then we'll have we have time for that tease. Eyeball to eyeball with the man that shot your father's plane down, with Susan Ruth. We'll be right back.
When you want the best selection of tropical fish, dog and cat grooming accessories, bird and livestock feed, or a pond for your garden, head over to Dave's Pets at 3515 Main Street in Exmoor, Virginia. Dave's Pets has the best selection on the Eastern Shore. Give them a call at 757-442-7442, 757-442-7442. Dave's Pets, the name you want to remember.
The one thing you want to be in your home is comfortable. From midwinter to the dog days of summer, you want to trust your home's heating and cooling systems. If yours is giving you fits, call the Herbert Senn Company, 757-442-6186. They're your local heating and air experts. Trust your comfort to the Herbert Senn Company, 757-442-6186. The Herbert Senn Company, always looking to hire qualified, motivated individuals.
It's time to eat, but everyone wants something different. Let me recommend Jerry's Restaurante, 22115 Langford Highway in Cape Charles. They serve the entire Eastern Shore of Virginia, from fresh slices for lunch or a full gluten-free pizza for dinner. Maybe try one of their subs, calzones, salads, or strombolis. Everyone will find something they'll love. Jerry's Restaurante, 22115 Langford Highway in Cape Charles,
877-331-1140. Open convenient hours. And police, teachers, military, and first responders get a 10% discount every day. Jerry's Restaurante.
Cape Vapes, 22157 Lankford Highway, offering the latest in vaping technology. With over 100 flavors to choose from, they also have nicotine salts and other repair services. At Cape Vapes, you are family. 10% off for military and first responders. Local customers always welcome.
Come by and see us at 22157 Lankford Highway in Cape Charles.
Or call 757-331-9355.
Welcome back to the Specialist Radio Hour.
This is America, Jack.
With Chris Kettner.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're talking to Steve Snyder. He is the son of Howard Snyder, who was shot down in World War II. Steve is the author of Shot Down, the true story of pilot Howard Snyder and the crew of the B-17 Susan Ruth. Are you there, Steve?
I am here.
Okay, keep on with that story. The people are riveted.
Okay. Well, the day that my dad's plane was shot down, they were on a bombing mission to Frankfurt, Germany. And they dropped their bomb successfully, but their bomb bay doors got hit by flak, and they couldn't get them back up. And as a result, that caused a drag on the plane. They lost airspeed, and they fell behind the B-17 formation heading back to England. And they were singled out by two German Focke-Wulf fighters, who, like wolves or lions, you know, came in on prey for the kill. And then ensuing air battle, the Susan Ruth was shot down. But both those German planes were shot down as well. One was piloted by Siegfried Merrick. His plane crashed, and he was killed in the plane. And the other plane was piloted by Hans Berger. And actually, the gunners on my dad's plane shot down Hans Berger, so they really shot each other down. Hans was able to bail out, and he made it through the war. And as I mentioned before the break, I was able to find Hans Berger. All my dad knew, and all the U.S. military, the Air Force knew, was that they were attacked by two German planes and shot down. And I thought that's all I'd ever know.
Well, here's the amazing part of the story that you haven't said yet. How many Hans Bergers? That's like Jones or Smith. People may not be aware of that, but in Germany, Hans Berger is as common as Jones or Smith.
Yeah. The way I found him is I went on Google and put in trying to find a Luftwaffe pilot, and a couple forums came up, which I joined, and I posted an inquiry because I knew that the day my dad's plane was shot down, the time of day, the location. And in a week, two guys got back to me, one from Belgium and one from England. And on that day, there were 12 B-17s shot down, and the one shot down south of Chimay, Belgium, was shot down by Hans Berger.
Wow.
For the book, I just interviewed Hans over the telephone and through email. But I've met him twice now. In 2016, I went to Munich. He lives in Munich, Germany.
All right, but wait a minute, you're not getting off that easy. The first conversation, Hans Berger, the guy that shot your father's plane down, that had to be awkward.
Well, I was so excited that I found him. I was beside myself. When I talked to him, well, the guy in Belgium who had contacted me, he was a Luftwaffe historian and written a number of books about the Luftwaffe and knew Hans, and he asked Hans it would be okay if I contacted him, and Hans said it was okay. And So when I start talking to Hans, I just start asking question after question after question. One time he said, Steve, you know, I really don't know you all very well, and you're asking me all these personal questions. But, you know, I built up his trust, and we eventually have become real good friends. He's 96 years old now. He turned 96 this last October.
Now, was your father still alive at the time?
Unfortunately, no. My dad died in 2007. He wasn't the last crew member to die, but he was the oldest at 91. And I didn't find Hans until 2013.
Okay.
And so,
a little bittersweet there.
Yeah, that would have been wonderful if the two of them could have met. Because Hans, when I got together, he goes, this is pretty incredible that I'm, you know, sitting here talking with the son of a pilot, the U.S. pilot that whose plane I shot down, and they shot me down at the same time. So, yeah, that's pretty amazing. Hans said it was unfortunate they had to be shooting at each other, but, you know, that was war. He was, you know, just like the U.S. airman, you know, he was 19, 20 years old, and he was fighting for his country, trying to do a job, and trying to stay alive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what people sometimes forget. See, there's a difference. Even though you had Austerlitz and things like that, the cruelty that went on, most of the people that were the pilots and the infantrymen, the cruelty wasn't there that you're seeing a lot of in today. I mean, there was a lot of cruelty in those concentration camps, but they were basically extermination camps, if you will. They wanted to exterminate the Jews completely. But I'm saying that in the war itself, when the war was fighting, most of the people, they just want to live and get out alive, and they'd like to have their side win, but win or lose, they want to get home. Am I wrong about that?
Oh, no. You're totally right. But a lot of there's a lot of people don't realize that the German military, you really had two parts. The regular German military were just like you're saying. You know, they were there to, you know, to defend their country or fight for their country. But the Nazis formed their own military unit called the Waffen-SS.
Correct.
And it was the Waffen-SS who really committed all the atrocities. The SS, they manned the concentration camps, the death camps, and they were really the brutal part of the German military forces. It wasn't the regular army, the Wehrmacht.
Yeah, and most of all, you almost never see that with pilots.
Right. Yeah, they had a code. You know, the Air Force, they respected the U.S. Airmen, the German Air Force called the Luftwaffe. And they went into different prisoner of war camps, in fact. The downed U.S. Airmen, they went into prisoner of war camps that were run by the Luftwaffe. They weren't run by the army or the SS. So they were treated better. You kind of had a code, if you will.
So you meet this guy face to face. We've only got about 4 minutes left. You meet the guy face to face. Tell us what happens.
Well, the first time I went over and met him face to face, we had a little camera crew with us, and we did an interview with him about 40 minutes, and we went to lunch across the street. We had a Wiener Schnitzel and an Augustiner beer, and it was just amazing to see each other. He brought out his military, his flight jacket and his Iron Cross. He shot down 7 B-17s and 1 Spitfire.
Wow.
During his time in the military. Yeah. After the war, that's where he learned to speak English. He became a translator, and he worked for the U.S. military occupation government in the denazification of the German youth, teaching them about democracy and trying to re-educate them about the democracy versus Nazism. And then he started his own translation school. after that. So we become good friends. A lot of people ask me, well, don't you hate this guy who shot down your dad's plane? And my dad's gunner shot him down, too. But Hans is part of my dad's life. There was no event in my dad's life that was, more important or more memorable than fighting in World War II. And at one point in time, my dad's life and Hans Berger's life crossed paths. So Hans is part of my dad's story, part of his life. And so I felt kind of a personal relationship for him.
And I'll tell you, kinship. And look, the story's a whole lot different. Now, if let's just take and we'll switch names for a minute. If you were the pilot that shot down John McCain, your feelings as John McCain's son may be a lot different.
True.
You know
true.
What I'm saying?
Because McCain went into a prisoner of war camp.
And was tortured for 5 years. It was tortured. So you might feel a little bit different. So your story is a lot different. So I can understand where he's just a part of your dad's life. It happened. It's an incredible, incredible story. But I think that we might have had a different curtain call, perhaps, if it had been John McCain's guy that was shot down. There might have been a little more animosity there.
certainly, yeah, yeah, I can, yeah,
from
without
the,
a doubt,
from the son or the daughter that was uncovering all of this. Did it give you any closure? Did it give you any information you didn't have?
Oh, yeah, 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 because that was part of the story that I didn't know, you know, from the other side, from the enemy, if you will, the German side. So that really completed the entire story.
And your father never lived to see the completion?
No, yeah, unfortunately, it would have been wonderful if he was, because the book was published